And welcome everyone to our Sunday afternoon slot, where our focus is on the earliest written record of A Course in Miracles, which is found in two collections of Helen Schuckman's manuscripts, her original shorthand notes, and her later edited transcript known as the Urtext. Now, for those who have not been with us before, I'm going to spend a couple of minutes just reviewing what this material is and what we're doing here. For the past few months, I've been going through the shorthand notes and identifying material which did not make it into the Urtext, and combining these two earliest and most original versions. The resulting document is not any one of the five notes, but rather a combination of the two earliest ones. It includes essentially all of the original dictation. This material does have some rough spots, some segments which were written down only in point form, and some sentences which were never completed. In that sense, it certainly does need some editing in places, in that it's not a finished product. The notes also includes some material specifically labeled as a private point and not intended to be part of the course. This includes conversations between Helen and Jesus about topics of concern to Helen at the time. While not part of the course proper, these outtakes, if you will, provide considerable insight into Helen's experience of scribing and often involve explanations of miracle principles, practical examples from Helen's own life, and as such, they expand our understanding both of the course proper and her scribing experience, which resulted in what we know today as A Course in Miracles. So what we'll be doing today is a reading, some commentary, and discussion of this material. We decided last week to go back and restart at the beginning of chapter 1, and we got as far as T1B9, I believe. And I'm going to post some URLs here so you can get a copy of this material to read along with us if you wish. For those on the radio who can't see the URL I post, you can go to www.miraclesinactionpress.com/DTHOMP74. And on the left-hand side of the page that will come up, under the word contents, the first item is the original dictation text 1-8. Click on that, and that will bring you to that very long URL that Deborah just posted, which is way too long to read, but that one that Deborah just posted will take you, I think, directly to the page with the material. Okay, Deborah, I'm going to hand you the mic for your own introduction here.
Hi, everyone. I don't know if this is going to work, this link, because I just clicked on it, and it wouldn't take me, and I'm trying to grab the thing up off the page so I can copy-paste it, and I'm not being successful doing that. Huh. That's the same link, I think. Right, Doug? Oh, man. No, it's not. Okay, let me click on yours. That one goes right through. I had actually copied the link from the top of your page, and that's what I was posting, and it does this long-winded change mid-air and plops down all those extra pieces of words. I'm going to copy yours and replace mine in Word is what I'm doing. So I just want to make a statement that this is the first time this material has been out exposed. So it's actually groundbreaking material, and I just feel it's so wonderful that it's been saved and kept, and we're able to read what Jesus has actually dictated to Helen, and what she has actually scribed down from hearing Jesus dictate to her, and getting that full connection of Jesus and Helen and their communion, that took place so many years ago, which really wasn't that long ago. So this is very groundbreaking. So Doug, you've written, yes, Deborah, that link you posted was for the old file we were using before. Aha, okay, I'll make sure that this is saved correctly then, Doug, so I've got it replaced. I'm pretty sure here. So I'll pass the mic back to you.
Okay, thank you for that. I'm just scrolling down here. If you go to that page and you want to find exactly the spot in your browser, hit Control F, which will turn up a find box, and then type T space 1 space B space 9 space return, and it'll go right to that paragraph. And you can do that with any of these paragraph references. They're all four fields. Four primary fields, which are separated by spaces, so it's really easy to type into a search box, and Firefox or Internet Explorer will take you right there. We are at T1B9. T1B9, T space 1 space B space 9, if you want to search for it. It's really just the third page of the Urtext manuscript. And yes, Deborah, in terms of your comment, this material was taken down in 1965 by hand, in handwriting. And was later typed and retyped and retyped and retyped and retyped with some editing, with some omissions, and with a lot of typing mistakes. And very little proofreading was done in the early years. So those mistakes, the scribes were entirely unaware of them, because the only way to find them would be through proofreading. Now, that material was kept secret for many years and has only recently come to light. In fact, I was not able to get hold of a copy of the shorthand notes until the year 2007. And then, of course, it's all handwritten, and a lot of it is actually shorthand. So one has to learn to read Helen's handwriting and her shorthand before you can even make use of this. So it's taken me some time to get that material transcribed with at least reasonable accuracy. There's some points where the handwriting and shorthand symbols leave me scratching my head. I don't know what she originally intended. Where that occurs in this document, you will see two or more question marks. And wherever you see two or more question marks, that means it's something I can't read. I don't know what's there, but there's something there. It's not nothing. And in this document we're looking at today, the material from the Urtext is in a regular font. Material that derives from the notes that is not in the Urtext shows up in a bold italic font. Now, one of the interesting things about the notes is that 99% of it is identical to the Urtext. So what you've really got here is a transcript of the notes, because only where the notes in the Urtext differ do we go into that bold type. Elsewhere, where the type is regular, literally the same. Not always letter for letter identical, but no significant difference. Certain minor things like spelling mistakes that were later corrected, etc., I don't preserve those as differences. But for the most part, yeah, any significant difference is shown here in bold type. Okay, Deborah, you've got that P3T1B9. It's P3 has nothing to do with it. It's T1B9. T space 1 space B space 9 space. Okay, so if I can actually get to that spot myself. That's where we left off the reading last week. And that's where we'll pick it up this week. And I'm going to ask Deborah to start reading at that spot. Note to me, delete the page number. Delete the page. Oh, I see. Page 3. Yes, it is page 3 of the Urtext manuscript. The previous file we were using, I had indexed by page numbers. This one is not indexed by page numbers. And another comment I should probably make about this one. The Urtext and the notes, neither of them have any chapter or section divisions marked in them. They are just continuous documents. In the case of the notes, it's like 3,500 handwritten pages for the text volume. In the case of the Urtext manuscript, it's 1,072 typewritten pages. To make the material more manageable for navigation, I went through it and inserted the section and chapter breaks from the Hugh Lynn Casey version. Now, while most of those are similar to the Foundation version, they're not always identical. And in the large segments in Chapter 1, where the material was entirely omitted, there are, of course, no section breaks from the HLC, because that material is not in the HLC. So what you see here are both the Foundation for Inner Peace section and chapter divisions. Those are inserted and indexed, so you can look up something in here from a Foundation reference. And I've put in additional section breaks where the topic shifts. Most of those are in Chapter 1. I think there's a couple in Chapter 2. And those are simply my own commentary, essentially. They're not part of the original material at all. The scribes had nothing to do with them. I'm putting them in to help, mostly myself, recognize where the material shifts from one topic to another for my own reference. Those do show up in the table of contents on the left, all of those. The HLC and the Foundation section breaks and the ones I've added. Okay, so that's all about this particular document. And okay, T1B9. Deborah, I'm going to hand the mic back to you.
Okay, thanks, Doug. I wanted to share something first before I start reading. Helen actually was working with people with mental disabilities, and as am I currently for the last number of years, over the span of 10 years, and I've been spending a lot of time with this young lady with autism, challenged with autism, and today we went out for a walk, and on the walk we just get started, and she starts, I want to go pee, I want to go to the bathroom. And when she gets these thoughts in her mind, I mean, she doesn't let them go. They're constant out to me. And so we're walking along, and I'm thinking, don't even give them any kind of attention at all. Just ignore what she's saying. So I'm ignoring her, and she gets right beside me, takes my hand, and she keeps telling me these statements over and over again. So we're walking for quite a while, and this is constantly going on. She's constantly, what if she has, well, I'm aware of whether she does or not, and no, she didn't. I know what her habits are, and I know where her isms are in her words. I've been working with her for years. So finally, I'm realizing I'm getting frustrated. And I've been with her for a number of days, and I'm coming into a four-hour break with her, too, coming up to that. And so I said to Holy Spirit, could you give her a message for me straight to her mind? Because I don't think she's getting it from me. And then I asked Holy Spirit to ask her in a nice way to cool it. And I got an immediate response back. It says, Deborah, it doesn't work that way. And with that came just the energy with this complete understanding. No, I have to work with it myself. So I said, okay, could you give me a different perception on this? Because I'm getting frustrated, and I don't quite know what to do with it, but this isn't working. So I'm going to let it go now, and it's all yours. And I let it go, and then in came the words, tell her to say, I'm going to go to the bathroom when I get home. And I went, wow, perfect. So I said, I've never tried this before, right? I've never, ever thought of this before. And so I said to her, the next time she said her one of her statements, I said, hey, honey, say this. I'm going to go to the bathroom when I get home. And I was pretty insistent that she pronounce every single word in that sentence perfectly. So I was helping her pronunciation at the same time. So she would say that. Every time she said a statement that I was not wanting to hear, then I gave her that statement again, and she would say it. And within very few statements, she stopped saying her statements totally. She went silent. And then the next thing I heard after a little while, she said, I want some music. And I said, we'll have music when we get home. And she smiled and she let it go. And I went, wow, that was just so really far out. It really was. It was, yeah, it is my lesson, Doug Coach. I really got that in the moment, right? Because I was dissociating from myself when I'm saying, could you give her this message, right? And it just came right back to me as, no, that's not the way it happens. So that was cool. So I will go into the reading now. We're on T1B9. Miracles are a kind of exchange. Like all expressions of love, which are always miraculous in the true sense, the exchange reverses the physical laws. I had an immediate question on this, Doug, and I didn't sit with it to let the message come out, but reverses the physical laws. Can I pass this mic to you right now, or do you want me to read a little bit more before you would address that? Go ahead. Here's the mic.
Reverses the physical laws. Yeah, this is, the question was about this, the last line of that sentence, second sentence of T1B9. Miracles are a kind of exchange. Like all expressions of love, which are always miraculous in the true sense, the exchange reverses the physical laws. That one, that line, I believe, survived into all subsequent versions. It was not, none of the editors stumbled over it too much. So, as I understand it within the context of the entire teaching of the Course, what it's saying here is that when love, genuine love, is being exchanged between two people or two entities, this would include between man and God, mind moves to another dimension in which physical laws, the normal, you know, law of gravity, our normal laws of physics, can be reversed or transcended or superseded, which would explain why some miracles involve events which appear to reverse the physical laws. People walk on water, spontaneous healings of severe illnesses occur, people suddenly know how to speak in a language they've never even heard before, let alone learn, you know, various things that would normally be considered physically impossible in the physical universe we're familiar with. Yet, it's also a fact that the miraculous doesn't always involve that kind of rearrangement of the laws of physics. Later on, there'll be a discussion of time, and I believe we had a bit of discussion of time last week. And time is one of the physical laws, and miracles are described as accelerating time, shortening time. Jesus describes himself as being in charge of both space and time, and that these can be rearranged to suit the purposes of the Holy Spirit and the purposes of the atonement. And when the miraculous is happening, when we are relating to each other genuinely in love, that happens. sometimes we see it as coincidences where completely, completely improbable events correspond to make something happen that wouldn't have happened, I mean, would be incredibly improbable, etc., etc. So I think that's addressing your question, Deborah. And if not, please say so. Here's to Mike.
I'm just realizing that I'm fragmenting here. So what I want to do is just come together. And I didn't take that time at all to focus and align and be with Holy Spirit all together as the group of us, and allow the full meaning to come up to us as the reading and Doug's commentary is taking place. So I'm just focusing in there right now, just focusing inside if everyone goes there. And as a reminder to Lord, heal me, asking for healing, Lord, heal me, and to help me perform the miracles you want of me today. I like to use those. It's real clearing, clearing the channel, clearing the space inside myself to be present. So it does kind of, Doug, but in a way I'm tripping a little bit on it. So I'm going to back up and read T1B8, and then I'm going to carry forth into the next few. So I'll go to T1B8. Miracles are a form of healing. They supply a lack and are performed by those who have more for those who have less. T1B9, miracles are a kind of exchange, like all expressions of love, which are always miraculous in the true sense. The exchange reverses the physical laws. So I get from that it uproots the physical laws. It puts the true meaning and allows the false meaning to fall away. I'll go on to T1B10. A miracle is reversal of the physical order because it brings more love to the giver and the receiver. A miracle is misunderstood when it is regarded as a spectacle. And T1B11A, the use of miracles as a spectacle to induce belief is wrong. They are really used for and by believers. T1B11B, Helen Schuckman has some fear about 11 and doubt about 9 and 10, probably doubt induced by fear of 11. Doug, here's the mic.
Okay, I just wanted to note how 9 and 10 are linked. And I should have mentioned that before. In point 9, we see the exchange reverses the physical laws, the exchange of love. And then in point 10, a miracle is a reversal of the physical order because it brings more love to the giver and the receiver. And within the physical order, that's not a physical property, that's a spiritual property. Love is not a physical property. Yet, as I believe it was Doug who pointed out, Doug Couch on the board here, or no, it was Lisa, cause and effect, and truth reverses physical laws because they're illusion. And sure, if the mind is the cause and the effect, what we perceive is going to change if our minds change, and love operates at the mind and heart level. Now, heart isn't exactly a word the Course uses much in terms of making a distinction between mind and heart. But a mind engaged in love would be operating at what we would consider the heart level, and the physical order is junior to that and responds to it. And then in point 11, the use of miracles as spectacle to induce belief is wrong. They are really used for and by believers. And that's really interesting because there's a great deal of Christian theology which talks about miracles as being performed in order to literally induce belief as spectacles to attract attention and demonstrate God's power. And many people have that idea that that's what miracles are about. And we're being told here a rather different idea, that they occur as the result of an exchange of love, and they're used for and by believers. And believer here would mean, I suppose, someone who at least believes in miracles and believes in love. And that their purpose is not to demonstrate to non-believers the reality. That application is mistaken. Sickness is an attack on the body. The miracle can heal the mind and thus reverse the effect on the body. Yes, that would... Okay. All right. Deborah, here you go.
Okay. Lisa, did you have something to add right there?
Hey, guys. I don't know if my pal talk's working right, but I had my hand up before when you asked that question, and then when I was wondering if you saw my hand, I ended up trying to put my hand down, and it wouldn't go down. And so I tried again, and then I got booted out of the room. And then then I came back, and I put my hand up again, and it just, I don't know. It didn't look like you guys were seeing that. But, okay. All right. Well, anyway, I wanted to make a comment about that, about two things now. One was that, you know, the reversal of physical laws and the expression of love. And that is, what I wrote was that sickness is an attack on the body, and the miracle can heal the mind and thus reverse the effect on the body. To really try to put this whole area really addresses the trying to force the miracle to direct it myself in the effect, in the world, in the physical form, you know, trying to change something on the level of form without healing it in the mind. It says, you know, if you're looking for a spectacle, if you're looking to, you know, if you're looking strictly for the physical to change and not getting what its true sense is, the induction of the spectacle, you know, basically the need for someone to see it to believe it, you know, show me, you know, in physical form and then I'll believe you, you know, but the reality is that you can't see it until you believe it. And that is really key. You know, that you cannot see it until you believe it. It's something that unless you, it's kind of like to say, you know, oh, I'll have faith in God if God will show me a sign. But I can't see a sign if I don't have faith. You know, so anyway, so that's what I wanted to say. It's kind of out of the flow of it because I had more to say before, but in my Harry Carey of getting in and out of the room here, I forgot what some of it was directly related to what your question was initially. Anyway, thanks for letting me share.
Well, you're welcome, and thank you, Lisa. Now, I'd also point out in that last line that Deborah had read, Helen Schuckman had some fear about number 11, doubts about 9 and 10, probably doubt induced by fear of 11. This is one of the many comments we find in this material that obviously isn't scribed from Jesus. Helen's writing this herself. She is describing her own thoughts, concerns, doubts. And that's the line as it appeared in the Ur text. The next line is the same it's the original form from the notes. And we see how the original form was modified into the urtext. And we haven't read that one yet. I'll just read it now because they relate. Number 10 makes me nervous, and 8 and 9 were very hard to arrange. So she's experiencing some difficulty taking this down. I think I understand that, as I should, but I'm not sure. And that leads into another very interesting little dialogue between Jesus and Helen, which we'll get to in a minute. Okay, Deborah, here's the mic.
Okay, I'm just going to carry on reading right here to keep the flow going here because there's a lot of material that we're trying to get through. So T1B11B-N2, so this is more notes. Anytime there's an N, it means that it's notes material. I don't think Bill wants this course, and I'm not sure I do either. He is very snappy. I think this is slightly true because something is bothering him, but he certainly is not very snappy. So why not try to help him instead of blowing it up into an obstruction? He helps you all the time. That's Jesus. I resent this, is Helen. He is supposed to help me, but I think I resent reciprocal arrangement because he is a man. Men are supposed to give to me, but this is not possible. T1B11B-N3. Note, I don't always feel this way. It's a danger signal now and just means something's wrong. Anyway, presumably, this course is an elective. T1B11BN4. No, it isn't. It's a definite requirement. Only the time you take it is voluntary. Free will does not mean you establish the curriculum. It only means you elect what to take when. That's where that came from then. It always sort of gave me the impression that it was right near the beginning of something, not sort of feeding in through the course. Here, Doug.
Well, yes, those familiar with the Foundation version will recognize that line occurs right at the top. This is a required course. Only the time you take it is voluntary. But in fact, that line occurred well into the dictation of the miracle principles as a response to Helen's question about this course, which of course she knew almost nothing about at this time. She was still in the first week or so of taking dictation. And she's not sure she's wants it. She's not sure Bill wants it. And she's thinking, well, it's just an elective. This isn't, you know, necessary. And Jesus clears up that thought very directly and very succinctly. No, it's not an elective. It's a definite requirement. Only the time you take it is voluntary. You can choose when to take it, but you can't choose whether or not to take it. Free will does not mean you establish the curriculum. It only means you elect what to take when. Now, for those who may be too far away from any academic environment to remember, electives and required courses, if you're pursuing a degree program, for instance, required courses are courses you have to pass or you don't graduate. Electives are courses you can take or not take. So any given semester, there will be a number of required courses for any given program and a number of elective courses. You have to take some electives, but the electives can be anything you want, basically. And this one is being stated as a required course. Now, we see one of the ways in which the material was edited, in that line, which was part of a discussion between Helen and Jesus, ended up being moved to a new location and stuck up front, which is debatably a completely reasonable thing to do. But the context we see is that of Helen's hesitation and uncertainty and assumption about it being an elective being cleared up. Nope, it's not. And now we move into Helen's dream diary, which is somewhat interesting material in some ways. This is definitely all Helen's stuff here now. This is basically her dream diary. It is only very indirectly related to the course. Its value to the student is it tells us a little bit about where Helen was at and how this material was already beginning to change the way she was thinking about things. So we're now at, oh yeah, right, Lisa, I love it when men are supposed to give to me, read Bill. I completely forgot about that one. That's a really important point, and it will resurface again. And frequently, the line occurs, Helen is being told to help Bill with his course. This course is being described as Bill's course, and Helen's role is to help him through her rather exceptional channeling ability, get it down. And there's a great discussion about why Bill can't get it directly himself. And he tries, but he needs Helen's help to get these words. Later, the story came out that the course was given to Helen and Bill was her secretary who typed it up for her. We will see, as it was originally stated in the words of Jesus himself, that the assignment given to Bill and the assignment given to Helen were not that at all. That Bill instigated it with his request to Helen, saying there must be a better way. Helen agreed to help him, and her words were, I will help you find it. And this is the answer to their collaborative prayer. And that's one of the interesting dynamics that emerges from reading the notes. And Helen's resenting this. I resent this. She uses the words, and she talks. This will be addressed more later on. Helen's having a hard time with being Bill's helper, and she wants him to help her. And back and forth with Jesus on this question occurs quite a bit, or at least several more occasions before we get through this chapter. All right, I think that's about all I have to say about that one. And now we're into Helen's dream diary. And again, a warning, this is not the course, this is Helen's personal stuff in the next few paragraphs here. All right, Deborah, here's the mic.
Hi, Maria. I just sent the link there. I saw you come in the room. And there's the link we're reading from where we are at. I don't know if my mic actually clicked in that time. Am I being heard? I've been feeling pretty confident that it's been going through. Okay, thanks. So we're on T1B, 11B, and 5. By the way, Teddy, I had the same similar thoughts. Maybe not to the oomph that was, but I was very surprised with Helen's statement about men. It was kind of took me aback. So dreams. One was of great distress. Esther left Amy with us. The us is ambiguous here. And we were stuck. I was very tired after an incredible day in which a lot of stress was involved and wanted to go to sleep but couldn't on account of Amy. I was trying not to get angry at Esther because I think I was aware that she had a very good reason for having to go away just then, and I should help her even though she didn't know the reason or maybe was offering her usual show of maximal impulsiveness and no sense. But really, did know the reason, but was hiding it because she didn't want to take credit for herself. T1B1, 11B, and 6. That's how you see people as they should be, and that helps be that way. T1B, 11B, and 7. Anyway, the whole dream was one big frustration. I'm just going to carry through reading without all the little paragraphs because it's so short lines. Problem, I was not listening. Aside, read the course. Yes, indeed, the way the course is given you is quite unusual, but as Bill says, you are not the average American woman, which is merely a fact. Your experience in this life has been atypical, and so has my evolutionary map. T1B, 11B, and 11. There was a dream a while back, which I keep forgetting, about a long winding tunnel like they have in those very big garages so they can drive cars up efficiently. They look as though they're going round and round, but actually they are very efficient. They are a very efficient means of getting up smoothly. There are no sharp turns, evenly. The grade is maximal, but not sharp, and has great space economy, on top with an American flag. Back to the dreams of last night, there was also one in which three animals, little ones, were in the same room, and I knew that. I had to keep them apart because they hated each other. Being so busy, this was a great additional strain on me. One of them was pregnant, and the other two wanted to kill her, but the other two also hated each other too. Oddly enough, I was quite sorry for all of them because they were all three mixed up, but in different ways. I felt that I had to get the pregnant one out first, though, because of the child. I thought this an improvement on the recurrent dream I had for years about animals starving to death and me sometimes grieving, sometimes trying desperately to help them, at times also realizing I had starved them and feeling very guilty, but never saving them. Wow, she yay, Helen. I really, really, really appreciate this lady. T1B, 11B, N13. Rockwell keeps coming in throughout, but his role is not clear. Maybe it's because of the Rockwellians, which is a very particular group. I'm not sure, but I think I invented the term myself. I was struck by Hannah Patterson's remark. I'm from the Minnesota group, but I know there must be a New York chapter. She liked the term and thought it was just right. Rockwellians have a real sense of devotion to one another and also to Rockwell himself. He was a very interesting man who never went by his emotions and usually denied them, but they were responsible for his many blind spots and denials. We all knew this, but were very gentle about it. Well, that's interesting there. He never went by his emotions and usually denied them, but they were responsible for his many blind spots and denials. That's so true of all of us, that's a real area that we can throw in huge blocks, and not see beyond that. I'm watching for you to raise your hand, Doug, and since you're not, I'm going to carry reading. The odd thing about Rockwellians is that I think all of us believed in the unconscious, which Rockwell himself opposes violently. I think we were all one together under his direction or teachership, and something happened. Go ahead, Doug.
Okay, actually, I wanted to comment a bit on the first dream about the parking garage and the ascending tunnel, in which you go around and around in circles like a spiral or a helix. And you get to the top, and there's an American flag. Now, I'm not exactly sure what the symbolism there is, but something symbolic, of symbolic significance at the top, which seems to me, in dream imagery, to be resembling her path with the course, going around and around, but rising eventually to something of significance that would be at the top. And no sharp turns. The grade is maximal, but not sharp. It's very efficient. This is the way to get to the top, to get to the goal, the symbolic goal. And then this material about Rockwell. Rockwell was a psychologist at the time, a behavioralist. I think, if I remember correctly, he was even essentially the founder of behaviorism in the early 20th century, late 19th century, and had a few blind spots, which Helen is discussing, and also had some very devoted disciples, and that particular group is what's being talked about in this later material here, which we're just about finished. And okay, Deborah, here you go.
We owe him a lot, both good and bad, and we're to help, and we're, I think that's supposed to be apostrophe RE, we are to help him now as a way out of the bad and a means of strengthening the good. The last dream was about a child on the CDP program. It seems that I saw the child's protocols and suspected some sort of rather obscure diagnosis or problem. I was unwilling to go on record because it was a medical thing and I thought Gates would disapprove, but I felt an obligation to the child and called her doctor about it. I got a letter in return saying the physician was very grateful and that the child's life was saved and the information was badly needed. T1B11C, when you say, if you want me to, I will, please add, and if you don't want me to, I won't. This is the right use of inhibition. There has to be some control over learning for channelizing purposes. Remember retroactive inhibition, which should be easy enough for you. T1B11D, sometimes the new learning is the more important and has to inhibit the old. It's a form of correction. Prayer is the medium of miracles. Prayer is the natural communication of the created with the Creator. Through prayer, love is received, and through miracles, love is expressed. Here's the mic, Doug.
Okay, I just wanted to comment on this inhibition, retroactive inhibition, which term pops up in 11C and a couple of times later. It's a psychological term which refers to a loss of information, the tendency of recently gained knowledge or skills to degenerate or be lost when new learning in a similar area is acquired too quickly. And if you want me to, I will, and if you don't want me to, I won't, is the right use of inhibition. Or losing learning that should be lost, I think is what the idea, I think that's the idea that would have been understood by a psychologist at that time from that kind of terminology. And then the term channelizing, which in psychology refers to repetitive learning. The more you repeat something, like memory work, memorizing, a mental channel of sorts is created. We now know that's actually reflected in physical changes in the brain, that synapses get hardwired. So again, we're talking about learning reinforcement, inhibiting or losing old knowledge that is obsolete or incorrect, replacing it with new knowledge, and then channelizing it through repetition and reinforcement to make that new learning solid. And in 11D, sometimes new learning is the more important and has to inhibit the old, and this is a form of correction. Then into prayer, which is the natural communication of the created with the Creator. Through prayer, love is received, and through miracles, love is expressed, which is a really interesting concept. Again, I would point out, as I pointed out before, that in chapter 1, It's a bit like a table of contents in that, for the whole book, in that topics come up, are addressed very briefly, and then we'll get back to them with more expansion and more detail. And here that we have the topic of prayer is one such example that we'll get back to again and again and again, finally culminating in the Song of Prayer volume, which goes into great detail about what prayer is, various different kinds of prayer, how they're most appropriately used, and how the communication with the Father through prayer can be cultivated by an individual. Okay. Hi, Don. I'm not reading much on the board. Okay, Deborah, here's the mic.
Thanks. Lisa, you wanted to add in here something. I'll pass the mic to you.
Hey, okay, I just wanted to, I just lost it, point out something for me that jumps out every time I read this. And that is when you say, if you want me to, I will, please add, and if you don't want me to, I won't. This is the right use of inhibition. There has to be some control over learning for channelizing purposes. In my communication with Holy Spirit and Jesus and whatever, anyway, that's what was taught to me. And that was before I read the course, that it was really, really important that it wasn't just to start, but it was also to stop. It was very important that I asked when to do something, when to hear something, when to ask something, when whatever, as well as when to not. In fact, the when to not was, how do I put this? It's Jesus talking to Helen and saying, you know, listen, you know, I want to be in control over this, over the channeling. I want to be in control over this, over the learning, over everything. You know, I want you to ask me when to write, when to not write, when to do this, when to not do this. You know, and her saying, well, if you want me to, I will. And him and Jesus saying, well, please add to that. And if you don't want me to, I won't, you know, so that you're really, really allowing the guidance to allow you to know what it is that you're supposed to do or not supposed to do, or what you're supposed to see, etc. You know, because otherwise there isn't any control. It's all, well, if you want me to, I will. But then there's still so much of the self, the ego in there of other things, and the don't want you to, the stopping part, isn't even in there for any control. There's no control, or there's little control over it. So I just wanted to point that out. Thanks.
Okay, I thought there was more about this that was coming up, or I don't think we've gone through that yet, because I thought there was this little blurb about it, and then it actually comes back in again more fully, but maybe I'm wrong about that. Doug, here's the mic.
Yeah, this line, if you want me to, I will, and if you don't want me to, I won't, I believe two or three times before this chapter's over, we come back to it, and Jesus asks the wording to be adjusted, which is quite interesting. This theme... yeah, we're going to come back to this theme before the chapter's over at least twice. Okay. Here's the mic.
Okay, yeah, that's why I kind of like wrote over it, because I knew it was a reoccurring theme that went more in depth. Thanks, Lisa. T1B12A-N1. The one more thing is Bill's fear of punishment for what is done now. Everybody makes mistakes. These errors are completely trivial. Tell him that when the past has been forgiven. These minor infractions are very easily altered. That is so fantastic. T1B12B. Miracles are thought creations. Thought can create lower order or higher order realities. This is the basic distinction between intellectualization and thinking. One creates the physical and the other the spiritual. And we believe in what we create. So, all right, I'm going to keep reading. I have a question there, but I just want to see if there's something that comes up in further paragraphs. But Doug, here, go ahead.
I'm thinking in terms of the understanding of lower order and higher order, which is one of several expressions Jesus uses. Others are physical eye and spiritual eye. Lower and higher is frequently used, physical versus spiritual, and intellectualization versus thinking, physical versus spiritual. Yeah, that's in here too. So thought, miracles are thought creations, is where we start. So miracles begin in our minds, and they can begin in my mind alone, or they can begin in as a result of communication between my mind and someone else's. And they can create higher or lower order realities. And we're being essentially told that they can operate at the physical or spiritual plane. And this further theme, we believe in what we create, which will be stressed and repeated and explained many, many, many times before the end of the text, that we believe in what we create, basically. I don't know how to put it better. As we create things, we reinforce our belief in that which we're creating. And that includes all of our thoughts and the manifestations of those that we experience. And if you had a question, Deborah, by all means, spit it out.
I think you were covering it there. And Maria, you had mentioned up here on the board, I'm reading, where was it? That helps with the earlier question. And then you mentioned joins with T1B9. And I flipped back to T1B9 and went, aha, yeah. So, Marie, did you want to share anything, what you have pieced together right there? Are you willing to take the mic right now? That was for you. Okay. Thanks, Marie, because that was nicely pointed out where that was coming together. But I'm not myself prepared to put that together right now without sitting with the material and going over it more in my mind. I don't know if you have, if you were, Doug, I would pass it to you if you were. If not, I'm going to carry on reading. And I posted the link there because where we're starting right now is at T1B13. So T1B13, a miracle is a beginning and an ending. It thus abolishes time. It is always an affirmation of rebirth, which seems to go back, but really goes forward. It undoes the past and the present, and thus releases the future. That is such a potent statement, because it just takes us in and keeps us in the present. The past is released. The past will not present the future in any tainted way of what is released. So it's oh man, this, I just totally love this paragraph. I'm in love with it. Here, Doug.
Well, yeah, this is one of the greatest paragraphs in the entire course. And later on we'll be told that forgiveness undoes the past in the present and thus releases the future. And the miracle undoes, I mean, miracles are very closely associated with forgiveness. because what blocks the manifestation of miracles in our life experience are grievances. And forgiveness is the device or the remedy for a grievance, and when the block is removed, the miracle flows. So the linkage between miracle and forgiveness is not being stressed here. It will be stressed later. And time is abolished. Time, the illusion of time being a linear progression of events, is what gets abolished. And it seems to go back, but it really goes forward, which is a fascinating kind of Zen-like riddle. So what we're being told here is that it undoes the past in the present, in the now, which we're later told is the only time that's real. And that releases the future from the bondage to things like past grievances, to which the future would be held ransom if the miracle of forgiveness, or the miracle period, were not released to undo our ideas about the past. Because remember, there is no past except in our minds, which will also be told later in the course. So this is again one of those lines that points to a number of extensive discussions and explanations that will come in later pages. It's a bit of an announcement of what's coming. And the next paragraph is also one of the greats. Here's the mic.
Carrying on with that bit there, it undoes the past in the present. It's specifically why it is not necessary to dredge up these stories about the past. So if someone's trying to work through issues, they do not need to go into the stories, story after story, grievances after grievance of the past. So if they cannot recall details, if they cannot recall anything, they don't need to. Some people will have to in order that they can just release that and have a sense of someone empathizing with them so they can get off the track. But it's just so reinforcing that we do not need to go there. We can work right now. Whatever comes for us in this present, whatever sickness shows up in the body because it's our tool, whatever thought comes right to the present, and go from there to release whatever is attached to that from our past, because like Dogen said, the past no longer exists. And I find this paragraph so amazingly potent for me because of being a mother, and I always pass this through my children, that anything that I have passed, any gifts of illusion or falsity that I have passed to my children, that something like this paragraph, that when something's released in the present of whatever had been created falsely from the past, it's also going to be released in them, because we are releasing for everyone when we release. And I may be wrong on this, about it maybe more direct with our children, because we have actually seeded stuff in there that can really send them in a different direction. So Marie, did you want to add something right here?
Unfortunately, Marie, there seems to be something wrong with your mic right now. These little technical glitches do arise sometimes. Yeah. Okay, so back to our reading. Miracle is a beginning and an ending. That's abolishes time. We did that. So that brings us to T1B14. And here's the mic, Deborah.
Okay, miracles attest to truth. They are convincing because they arise from conviction. Without conviction, they deteriorate into magic, which is mindless and therefore destructive, or rather, the uncreative use of mind. T1B 15A. Each day should be devoted to miracles. God created time so that man could use it creatively and convince himself of his own ability to create. Time is a teaching device and a means to an end. It will cease when it is no longer useful for facilitating learning. I want to read this paragraph again. It's T1B15A. Each day should be devoted to miracles. So that's that. I'm going to pass it to you, Doug, because I want to hear what you have to say. Here you go.
Well, it does warrant reading again. I'm going to go back to 14 for just a moment. Miracles attest to truth. All right. They are convincing, and this is a key function of miracles, that they convince us. They are witnesses to truth in our experience. Not that they're spectacles to induce belief, but they're witnesses which channelize or reinforce belief. And they arise from conviction. Conviction is a strong form of belief. So there has to be some belief before there's going to be a miracle. They arise from conviction. And without conviction, the idea of a miracle is like magic, like a magic spell. We don't really believe it, but we'll say abracadabra and think that, well, maybe something might happen even though we don't expect it. And that's mindless and therefore destructive, or rather uncreative use of mind. I think there's some very interesting concepts which are going to be expanded later. And then 15A, each day should be devoted to miracles. And miracles are testaments to the truth which arise from conviction. And hear this magnificent statement. God created time so that man could use it creatively and convince himself of his own ability to create. Somewhere in the separation, we lost our awareness of our ability to create, our divine ability to create, given to us by the Father when he created us in his own image. And so time arises as a remedy to remind us or help us remember or convince us, convince and conviction. Note the linkage of those two very, very closely related words. To convince himself of his own ability create. And time is a teaching device and a means to an end, and a temporary one, because it will cease when it's no longer useful for facilitating learning. So why do we find ourselves in time, where there seems to be a past and a present and a future? And some wit once scrawled on a washroom wall, time is simply a device to prevent everything from happening at once, which I think has a great deal of truth to it. It separates the totality of the universe into, literally like slow motion, into apparently separated discrete events that allow us to understand the relationship between cause and effect and see the effects from our own causes. When we act in a way to cause something in time, we see the effect separated. They're not simultaneous as they are in reality or eternity. And that this is a teaching device for our somewhat deranged, insane minds, which is an extremely interesting idea of time, that it is, yes, an illusion in a sense, but it's an illusion created for our learning. In other words, a necessary illusion, without which the learning what we have forgotten could not take place. And that really summarize, that's really the miracle principle there. We now get into some other stuff after that. Okay, here's the mic.
Okay, I wanted to also point out what was really standing out for me there was each day should be devoted to miracles. For some reason, Helen had it bracketed about the time thing, so my mind went to this: each day should be devoted to miracles. And Jesus has made it clear to us that miracles, we need to be performing miracles that are requested us to perform, not taking it in our hands and just randomly performing miracles. So again, it was that, help me to perform the miracles you want from me today. Jesus has requested us to begin our day with that prayer. And to me right here is a reinforcement of that. Each day should be devoted to miracles. And also with the paragraph above about they arise from conviction. By the way, thanks, Doug. And by the way, because I always find your commentary very clear. And I also wanted to mention or say to Patricia here, yeah, on the bathroom wall, eh? I mean, I think maybe we go to the wrong bathroom. Gee, of course, the miracles in men's washrooms. Here, Lisa, you wanted to comment.
this is actually... I just absolutely love this whole paragraph so much, because, you know, in true forgiveness, realizing that nothing really happened, but yet the power of my mind to delude, to create stories and to suffer, to attack myself and blame it on my brother, to go through all that, the power of my thoughts are so strong. And in the unlearning with the Holy Spirit literally, by healing my mind, by undoing all of it, shows me the power of my own thoughts, and that used rightly for creation instead of making up stories, shows me how the right use of my mind, but also just the power of it. And so it's kind of like preschool, you know. It's kind of like, you know, you're there, you're making all these things, and you're, or maybe not preschool, but although we were making little projects and stuff, but it's kind of like, you know, you're there and you're playing and you're making all these things, and you know, and you're so able to make all these things, but nothing really happens. You know, it's all like a test run. You know, nothing really happens. It's all playing an illusion, totally unaffecting anything that's real. Totally unaffecting anything that's real, but yet learning at the same time. You know, it's like a safe little playground to just, you know, see the power of your own mind, and that the suffering happens when we believe that it's real. And it only happens when we believe that it's real, you know. And so I really, really love this whole paragraph. And the one part where each day should be devoted to miracles, I love what Deborah was sharing. Every moment should be devoted to miracles, because I need to be miracle-minded. I need to be right-minded. I need to be seeking the truth and to be coming from that, from spirit, all the time. You know, it's not about me out there in the world performing a miracle for someone else. It's never for someone else, ever. In fact, if I ever think it's for someone else, I need a miracle for that. I need a shift in perception for that belief that there is someone else, which ultimately is the totality of the forgiveness. But that every moment should be devoted to that. And so every morning waking up, you know, and saying, you know, help me to perform whatever miracles you want of me today, knowing that in doing so, that's what my intention is for the day. That's what my intention is moment to moment, is to heal. That is what the purpose of everything is literally getting in line with the Holy Spirit and the Holy Spirit's purpose, which is to use everything for my healing. So I just wanted to point that out too, and thanks for letting me share.
Well, thank you, Lisa. I like that idea you were mentioning, and I think of the model, the cosmic model of physical reality here in space and time, as something akin to a flight simulator. I'm not sure how many people are familiar with those, but they're machines that completely resemble the cockpit of an airliner, and they're used to train pilots in a variety of skills, like how to do something like land a 747 if you have no engines. That's not something you want to do in a real 747 to train a novice pilot how to do it. So they create these flight simulators, which for the trainee create an environment that feels like, sounds like, looks like the real thing as close as technology can be done. And that way the student can make mistakes without killing himself and, you know, eliminating an airliner. And that way even seasoned pilots can be taught how to handle certain kinds of emergencies that weren't even known about when they took their training. And one can imagine that if one was in a flight simulator and you didn't know it was a flight simulator and you thought it was real, the fear could completely overcome you as you saw the plane diving towards the ground or something. And that actually does happen sometimes to pilots in real life, that in a dangerous situation, fear overcomes them and they can't properly exercise the skills they have. But as you know, it's a simulator. It's like, oh damn, I'm going to fail this test if I end up crash landing, but I'm not going to die. And tomorrow I'll get to take the test again and maybe I'll get it right. So nothing real, quote unquote, is at risk. And when I think of space and time and bodies as teaching devices, I think of flight simulators, that we are given an opportunity to learn in which nothing real is threatened, nothing eternal is threatened by my mistakes. My experience in the simulator certainly can be threatened by my mistakes, but the whole purpose of the thing is to help me and you learn how to not make those mistakes and develop what? Miracle mindedness, develop an awareness of the truth, develop an ability to distinguish between truth and falsehood, what's important and what's not. And this leads into the whole manifestation of the real world. The Holy Spirit's primary function is to correct errors. Like the instructor in the flight school, when the student crashes the simulator, the instructor will point out what the errors were and help him for the next day's test so that he will know what to do. The Holy Spirit's function, he is our teacher. He is called our teacher. There is one teacher, and that is the Holy Spirit. And as we learn miracle-mindedness, what happens is a transformation of physical reality, not just a suspension of physical laws, but, as the Course goes on to describe, a real world, which is still on planet Earth, still in space and time, but characterized by peace, joy, harmony, the solution to every problem, and even the gate of heaven. At which point, God takes the final step and translates Earth into heaven. That is the course, that is the curriculum, to learn the miracle-mindedness, which results in a change in our minds, an awakening to reality in our minds, which transforms the experience of life in space and time until we have learned all the lessons and it no longer has any use for us. So the student who has learned everything he can learn in the flight simulator won't be sent back to the flight simulator. He'll be flying the plane you ride on next time you want to go somewhere. And he'll be qualified and competent to do so. Okay, that's what I had to say about that, and thank you, Lisa, because that kind of inspired that thought. And I think it's a really important concept to bear in mind about this whole teaching about nothing really matters, it's all an illusion. It doesn't mean it's not important. I mean, the guy in the flight simulator can't say, oh, this doesn't matter, it's all an illusion, I don't have to pay attention to my lesson. I can go ahead and crash this plane, the world won't end, I won't die. Well, that's all true, but he also won't learn if he takes that attitude. In any learning situation, the curriculum presented to us is there for us to learn, and we must pay attention to it, and it does matter for our learning that it be understood correctly and properly, and only the Holy Spirit can really teach us, ultimately, what that correct understanding is. And we will know based on our experience whether we've got it or right, the same way the student in the flight simulator knows whether he's figured out how to land the airliner correctly, depending on whether or not it goes boom at the end of the session. And if it does, well, his curriculum, his issue is to figure out what mistakes he made, try again, and not make the same mistake. He might make new ones, but eventually he'll have figured out all the mistakes and he'll get that plane safely on the ground. And when I ride in an airplane, that's the guy I want at the controls. The guy who knows how to do it. Okay, I'm going to give you back the mic, Deb.
Okay, and I'm going to throw a little bit of a curveball in here, possibly, too. Because when I was just reading into where we were going to continue reading, which I'm posting right now, and I noticed that this 15A and 1 says, note, I got afraid during the part in brackets, ask Bill, and the part in brackets I would imagine is from the paragraph above where it starts talking, Jesus starts talking about, or in brackets is about time. And I suddenly started thinking, okay, Helen is afraid again, and we cannot hear guidance, Christ's guidance, when we are in a state of fear. We block it all. We block out Christ's guidance. So somehow in there we have to be able to release, even if we're a little speck of a hole, so that suddenly the Christ guidance can start coming through and it shifts us from there. So it's so occurring to me that because Helen had so much fear, she was taking a dictation from Jesus through 7 years, and she had fear upon fear upon fear upon fear, and she still was able to get this dictation coming through from Jesus. I just find that incredibly remarkable. So it's either that she didn't have to, what am I saying? It's that she did not have to go through this huge purification process in order to take the dictation from Jesus. She would need to go through the purification process in order to be a one-to-one correction for herself, getting that voice of Jesus. That just sort of came to mind. I don't know if you had anything to address with that, Doug. Had any thoughts that come up with that? But I, for some reason, was thinking about that. You're saying, right, fear blocks love and communion with at the spiritual level. But it would be only her own healing level, not through the level of taking some information that she resisted and fought and didn't even want to accept most of the time. Ego distraction for Helen, Peter says. And Lisa's saying not true. Not true what? Here's the mic, Lisa.
Well, you know, fear is going to be there, as well as all kinds of thoughts of guilt and stuff. And so what's really necessary is for any miracle to be performed is the willingness to detach. So to go from being completely aligned with the egoic thought to step into the observer and say, oh, I'm observing that I'm afraid of this. I'm observing that I'm suffering because of this, or I feel guilty because of that, or I'm angry because of this. I'm observing it. And in the communication with Jesus or Holy Spirit, it's important to say that, to say, you know, I realize that I'm afraid of this. I do want the truth in this. You know, I want to know what the truth is about this, or, you know, I'm aware of this. And so really the difference is that it's impossible to hear what the truth is if I am completely married to the belief that I have that's causing that fear, that guilt, that anger. You know, if I totally believe that it's right, then I'm not going to seek another way of looking at it. But in the detaching from it, owning that, yes, that is what I feel, you know, and bringing it to Jesus for healing, or bringing it to the Holy Spirit for healing, that's for the purification. That's for the miracle, you know. And in that state of literally detaching from it, you know, saying, hey, this is what I'm thinking, this is how I feel, I know that I'm suffering, I need not be. You know, what is the truth here? In that, I have already begun to completely shift over into my right mind and bring it, literally bring the darkness to the light and allow the Holy Spirit to show me what the truth is. Allow the truth to be revealed, you know? So that's what's so amazing about it, because a person doesn't have to be, you know, completely healed to be able to hear what the truth is, to be able to channel, to be able to hear the voice for God. You know, in each moment, it is whether or not I'm willing to detach from the egoic belief, the lie, so that I can hear the truth, you know. And the fact that she was doing that, it didn't mean that all of the thoughts were healed yet. It meant that she was able to detach and ask for the healing and bring them up for the healing, you know. So it's, I really truly get the strong, strong guidance about this that says, you know, be careful to say, you know, that fear in and of itself is a block, you know, because it really isn't. Because once I have become aware of it and already detached from it and said, okay, I know that this thought that I have is causing me fear, and I want to know what the truth is, you know, I get that this is how I feel, whatever like that. I bring this up to the Holy Spirit. I am miracle-minded because I am shifting over with the Holy Spirit to have it heal. And in that space, hear what the truth is, you know. I'll say this last thing and then I'll drop the mic. I have been in many, 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 many situations where I have felt the fear and the guidance really almost simultaneously. It cannot be simultaneously, but almost simultaneously, where I know that I am being guided through it to look at it with the Holy Spirit and to realize that it is nothing, you know, where there's this knowing with it, where there's this, you know, gentle, knowing, loving presence where everything really is okay. And at the same time, there's this thought that's making me crazy that I have, and literally bringing it in that same space and choosing the Holy Spirit, and the Holy Spirit showing me what the truth is and walking through it, you know. Like, the only way through some of this stuff is really through it, to get to the other side, to know what the truth is about it, and to realize that it was never real, you know. So that's all I wanted to share about that. Thanks.
I think that's a really fascinating point about fear and its remedies and its role. And, you know, there's the line, there's no room for fear in love. Perfect love casts out fear. Those are from the Apostle John in the New Testament, and they're quoted in the course. Fear does act as a block. Obviously, if we master the fear, or detach from the fear, or stand back from the fear, the blocking power of that fear is lost, and we can invite in healing. Where fear becomes a tyrant is when we get lost in it. I'm tempted to use the word panic, which most people can recognize is fear gone to the irrational level, where fear is so strong, it takes over the mind totally, and there is no capacity in the state of panic even to do obvious things like walk away from a fire. You know, it's people, when people panic, they tend to do completely counterproductive, irrational, unhelpful behaviors in response to whatever they perceive as a danger. So it is really important when, and the course goes into this many, many times, know that this is fear. And know that when you're looking at a fear, you're looking at an illusion. It's not true. It doesn't need to be reacted to. There is a remedy for it. The remedy is love. Ask for help at that point. Otherwise, the fear will literally sweep you away, and you will be insane. And your capacity to respond constructively to the situation will be gone. And when we can recognize that it is fear and say, I'm not going to listen to that fear. I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to understand that fear as an option I don't need to choose and a teacher whose lessons I don't want to take right now. As for Helen and her fears, Helen is a very fascinating person, and there's a couple of questions been typed about that. You know, she was later to say that I don't agree with any of it, the course, but I know it's right. She and Bill both were confronted with, I mean, both were senior academics, senior research scientists, professors at a prestigious university. Bill was chairman of the department. Editor of a couple of academic journals, a very, very, very senior scholar in his field at the time. And they're being presented with this very unscientific set of ideas that tended to contradict their own personal belief systems about what the world is and who they are, and what's good and what's bad, and what should be pursued and what shouldn't be pursued. And that triggered fear in both of them. And the fear was, my whole life is meaningless. My whole career is meaningless. My whole job is meaningless. Everything I think is meaningless if this is true. Those were the kind of ideas that the course teaching presents to many people as students of the course begin to grasp just what Jesus is telling us here. It's like, well, if that's right, then I'm wrong, or what I thought was true isn't. And that can be a little scary. And Helen wrestled with this, I would say, throughout her life. And even on her deathbed, she was still wrestling with it. That the, you know, the I know it's true, but I don't believe it. Conflict. I mean, those are two completely incompatible statements. If you know it's true, then you believe it. If you don't believe it, you know it's not true. I mean, how can you, you know, it specifies a split mind in conflict with itself and not having found a resolution. And I don't think Helen in her lifetime ever did reconcile that split within herself. But that's another story. Despite that, there was enough of her able to tune in to Jesus to scribe the course with a remarkable degree of accuracy. And this next paragraph refers directly to this issue. and I'm going to read it here. It's T1B 15B, special instructions. Notes on this course have to be taken only under good learning conditions. The same goes for review periods. I will tell you when, but remember to ask. And this relates back to what we were talking about before. I will do, if you tell me to, I will do it. And if you tell me not to, I won't do it. Remember to ask. And there were times when Helen was a clear channel, and there were times when she was completely conflicted and couldn't get anything straight. And that's one of the things we're referring to here. Okay, I'm not reading the board at the moment because I'm focusing on this text. I'm going to hand the mic back to Deborah, and I think we're now at 16A, and I will read the board for a moment while that's happening. Here's the mic, Deb.
Thanks, Doug, and thanks, Lisa. And this last point that you just read, Doug, I will tell you when, but remember to ask. Helen was absolutely remarkable, and just remarkable, because she obviously remembered to ask, so or it wouldn't be happening. I find that just going over this information right here, knowing what I've read from lots of accounts of Helen having huge resistance, and coming from Helen's mouth through the reading, what she's written down, I should say, talking about her resistance as well. I just find it very lightening for me. I feel this sense of lightness come through me when I read that, knowing that Helen could have such resistance. And like Carmen pointed out on the board, that we just have that openness, that willingness to openness, how amazing that is. It lightens any little, even bit of guilt that I have inside me. It also lightens that, lets it free flow and not come down on myself for not being through that. Peter, you have something to add here.
Thanks, Deb. I know that I can't judge, quote unquote, anyone else's process. So it's really, kind of difficult for any of us, I think, here to know anything about Helen's process. But at a gut level, I really feel, and I just posted it, I really feel like Helen came here only to scribe the course. And, she seemed to have a lot of hang-ups and a lot of quirky, weird type of behavior. But I truly believe that she was only brought here to scribe it, to get it done, and then when it was all finished, when all of her scribing was finished, she was finished, and she performed what she needed to do at this point in time. And, that I don't think in this particular body, incarnation, whatever you want to call it, that Helen was lacking for anything, and those close to her knew, that she was really, she was like the mystic's mystic or whatever. Anyway, just wanted to put that in there because I feel like she was pushing, perfect, example of, not really, yeah, pushing. I don't know where that came from. Passing gossip. No, it's just, I can't judge anyone else's process. I don't know what anything is for. And I think that Helen did everything that she was meant to do, in this time, this lifetime.
I actually want to add something to that because for me, I feel the same way. It's like, let's say we're on Pal Talk and somebody gets up onto the microphone and they're going through a particular healing phase. Something's come up to heal. And the only time you've seen them is when they're in that space. And so then you make this judgment based on what you heard or where they were at that day about them overall. And so, like, in your mind, you have a story. You have a story about where they are, how they are, if they're, disconnected or split or whatever's going on. And then, you missed it, but the very next day, they're clear again. They're on the other side of that healing. They have all this stuff to share about it and whatever. And so even in reading all of this, even Jesus's comments to Helen about, this is what your problem is, this is what this is, it's still in the process of her healing. And so one has to assume that, some of that is going to change because it has to change. I mean, it's constantly changing. You know, and the very fact that Jesus is bringing to Helen's attention in the first place is for her healing. You know, like especially, you know, when he's talking to her about, you know, her and Bill and saying what their particular issues are with denial, you know, and how they need to help each other to heal. Well, I mean, if the story stops there and you say, wow, so Helen really was very dissociated and Bill really was highly repressed. Well, okay, well, then that's the story about Bill and Helen, but that's not the story about Bill and Helen. You know, it is impossible, like Cynthia says, to look at, or at least I will say like my own interpretation of what Cynthia said, but just it's impossible to know anything about anything when it comes to them. We don't know anything really about what's really going on in anybody but ourselves, and even that we're on a need-to-know basis, and we're constantly healing, you know. So, but it is helpful going through and reading this and finding, you know, the process of Jesus working with Helen to help her to be more aware and to heal her mind. And Bill, and why is it so helpful to me, I'll say this last part, is that, you know, I will identify with certain things that Jesus is bringing up, either talking to Helen about Helen or Helen about Bill or Bill about Bill, and I will identify with that because that's up for my healing in that moment, and I get to realize, like, wow, I thought the same thing, and oh, and I get to heal too. Now, in that moment, you know, that's really the whole thing that's beneficial about anything only, is not whether or not, you know, she felt this way, she didn't feel this way, she had fear about this, she didn't have fear about this. The very fact that, you know, she's healing, everybody's healing, means that nothing is ever, no man stands in the same river twice, So it's like, it's the same, it's impossible to say, this is about Helen, this is about Bill, but just really appreciating the process and the sharing of the notes are really putting a really awesome, you know, really intimate picture about her healing, you know. So I love it, you know, but to say one thing or the other is only helpful if it's helpful. But anyway, I just wanted to share that. Thanks for letting me share.
Well, Lisa, that time I didn't actually let you share. You just grabbed the mic. Please, people, when you want to say something, put your hand up, but wait for Deborah or I to ask you to take the mic. Otherwise, this becomes an open mic session, and that's not really what I have planned here. Cynthia, I don't think we're gossiping about Helen. I think Helen is saying, I was afraid about that. And the question is, well, why was Helen afraid? And putting ourselves into her shoes and understanding how one can be afraid in such situations. Helen tells us and has left to us a great deal of information about her experience and her feelings. And the question, an important question about all of this material, is how much came from Helen and how much came from Jesus? Who was Helen? Who was Jesus? Could Helen have done this on her own? Some people think that she wrote it and that she wrote it in a delusional state. Other people think that it was channeled from Jesus. Other people think there is no Jesus, and she was quite confused in thinking she was channeling Jesus, but she was channeling something. These ideas come up. And if we look at what Helen herself has to say, I think we can understand more fully what her experience actually was. And we can answer questions such as, did she just make this up? Or was she getting this from Jesus? Or was she inventing a Jesus and getting it from somewhere else? And those are significant questions, at least in some people's minds. And this material, her own statements about her experience, to my mind, help clarify to those who want clarification just what was going on with her and for her as this material was coming through. And then another relevant question is about the editing and why she made certain changes that she made. If we understand who she was and what was making her tick, it's easier to understand or interpret modifications that were made later. So, you know, it's not gossiping about Helen. It's trying to understand how this material has come to us through the individuals through whom it came, who have left us a great great deal of information about their own experience. Inquiring egos want to know. Yeah, and some people do. And for other people, these questions are entirely irrelevant. And they're just not interested in them. And that's fine. If you're not interested, then you're not interested. Others, well, they want to address that question. And there's information available which can help us address it. Anyway, we are now on... Actually, we just... I just read 15b, special instructions, about, once again, Jesus reminding Helen to ask, which brings us to 16a, and we have 12 minutes left, so we can get through 16a. I don't think we can get through the Wally's Chalice segment in 12 minutes. So, Deborah, here is the mic.
Thanks, Doug. I think probably I'm willing to wager that everybody in this room is a huge fan of Helen. We are so in love with Helen. Helen has done amazing things. And has brought us the gift of A Course in Miracles. And as Carmen says here, I really love what you wrote here, Carmen. She proves it's okay for each of us to doubt. We can still be used, and I think that's lovely. And I think it's lovely too, Carmen. It's really precious. So I'm going to be carrying on reading here on T1B 16A. Miracles are teaching devices for demonstrating that it is more blessed to give than to receive. They simultaneously increase the reserve strength of the giver and supply the lack of strength in the receiver. Be very careful in interpreting this. T1B16A-N1, so some notes. Regarding Wally's chalice, does this mean he is on my list? Not necessarily, only that you, of all people, should know that it frightens people if you hand them back their own chalice. Doug, before I go further, here's the mic.
Okay, this section on Wally's chalice is long, and it's intricate, and it's complicated, and we've only got 10 minutes left, and we're not going to get through it in 10 minutes. Probably it'll take more like 20 or 30. So I think this would be a good place to stop. And we'll pick up with that one next week. The issue of fear has come up a lot today in terms of the fears Helen's expressing and sort of the theology of fear. What is fear? How do we handle it? Back in point 12, Bill's fear of punishment is mentioned. And we're told errors are completely trivial. And Helen is told to tell him that when the past has been forgiven, these minor infractions are very altered. And that connects to the idea of miracles undo the past in the present and thus release the future. And I think that's a really key theme that we've touched on but not really gone into. What is the past, and how is it that the past is altered in T1B12A and 1, tell Bill that when the past has been forgiven, these minor infractions or errors, everybody makes mistakes, are easily altered. And we're also told that the past is undone in the present and releasing the future. And I think a key thing here is that the past exists only in our minds. This is a problem historians wrestle with in terms of the philosophy of science quite a bit. Like, just what is the past that we as historians are actually writing about? We can find evidence in terms of archaeological digs and physical artifacts and journals and documents and newspaper reports, etc., from past events. But it's only a mental construct we're building about it. And in a real sense, so is the present, because the present is, to the ego, to physical perception, an infinitesimally small division between past and future. I mean, what I said when I started this sentence is in the past by the time I finish this sentence. And what was it? And what can I know of it except what I make up about it, what I perceive? And those perceptions, of course, are made in my brain. They're inventions. They're stories. And the story changes when my opinion or evaluation changes. So I can look at the past, like Adolf Hitler, and see, you know, a vile, terrible, evil character. That's one way of understanding the past. Or I can look, say, through forgiving eyes and see a tragically mistaken brother who was totally lost in his fear and encouraged many others to lose themselves in their fear, and kind of a horrible orgy of fear, which is a far different past than one of this terrible evil character who visited devastation and disaster upon so many. The past is always in our minds. And in that way, the miracle and the act of forgiveness really does change it. And this leads into the whole question of perceptions and how we perceive and how we come up with stories about the past. And the most surprising thing that psychology is teaching us today about memory of the past and human perceptions of what happened in the past is that it is grossly inaccurate. Very few people remember more than relatively minor details with precise accuracy. And our minds make up stories about what happened before. They make up a biography for us. There's bits and pieces of objective fact, like I went to this school in that year and, you know, things like that. But the meaning of it is not just a fabrication that we make up in our minds. It is an evolving fabrication, because the stories we tell this year are different than the stories we told 10 years ago about something that happened 30 years ago. They change. There is no hard and fixed past in our minds. And in this sense, this is how I understand what Jesus is saying here, that when the past has been forgiven, those minor infractions are very easily altered. Which is to say, any mental traces of guilt about a mistake I may have made vanish in the presence of forgiveness, which is itself miraculous. And we have 5 minutes left, and that was what I sort of wanted to mention in terms of summarizing what material we've covered today. The idea that fear, an idea raised by Lisa, that fear is only a block when we succumb to it, and that it can be mastered or overcome, understood, ignored, and denied, I think is also really critical. That fear is not to be feared. Okay, Lisa, I see your hand up. We have 4 minutes left, so please try to be brief. And I also want to point out that these sessions are being recorded and will be on my website. Well, previous ones are. This one will be up probably this evening sometime. In case you missed part of it or missed another session and want to check out those sessions. Okay, and Anne, you have your hand up. Okay, remember, time's short.
No problem. Time is of the essence. I just want to share quickly a little bit on that fear aspect. I was watching some of Dr. Hawkins today. I think he clarified more in simplicity for me that when we perceive, we're connecting A, B, and C when we're developing a fear, that we're putting things in a linear form. So when we're perceiving something, we attach to certain things and we put A, B, and C. That creates a story in our mind that could create a fear or a false understanding or perception or idea. And in a sense, really what's happening, things are just happening separate and of on their own. They are actually not connected one to the other. It is us who actually makes them connected to the other. So so we build our own fear and our own stories. And so actually everything is happening and occurring separate and of itself. And therefore, if we don't attach to it, it is separate.
Okay, Teddy, you got 2 minutes. Or 1 minute. Take it away.
I hope you guys can hear me. So, you know, the one thing that I did want to say is, though, you know, it became obvious to me about when we first started to put together the Sparkle Edition that Jesus was really asking Bill to begin to develop, you know, a new psychology, a new psychotherapy based on the principles and the corrections that Jesus was giving them for the way psychotherapy and psychologists were looking at you know, the human psyche and mental disorder and disease. So, you know, it's like one of the things that I had done was put together a pamphlet of all that stuff. But I really do believe that he was actually urging Helen and Bill to develop a new psychotherapy based on what he did, what the corrections that he made, and the truth of, just like Helen said, you know, I don't believe it, but I know that it's true. You know, all of us know that it's true based on how we initially come to it and actually deny it and react to it, because the human mind, there, like we are of one mind, and the mind that was created by God is the universal mind, and it works one way and one way only. Yeah, but the PPP doesn't really get to the point of the corrections that he does that he makes of both Jung and Freud, and the use of defense mechanisms, the positive use of defense mechanisms, as opposed to just the negative connotations that defense mechanisms have. So while psychotherapy practice and purpose is important and is helpful, the corrections that are made within the ER text and within the other material that Doug has translated really go a long way to establishing this as the valid psychotherapy for the age of enlightenment here.
Okay, Deborah, you want to take the mic and say your goodbyes? Thank you, everybody. Our time is up. Carmen's on next. For those on the radio, once again, the website is www.miraclesinactionpress, all one word, .com. And through that, you can get recordings of this and previous sessions. Goodbye, God bless, and thanks all.
Hey, yeah, thanks, Doug. And I want to thank everybody for joining us in a space of love and in the context of healing all together with this amazing information that's being presented, that's coming through, that we're able to bring here to light.